political prisoners are released, the day that our women, they are no longer killed or jailed for refusing to wear the veil, the day that we will see Narges Mohammadi or Tumay Salehi back in the street, the day that we will have a free press, then okay, let's talk about the reformists. Until now, they're just dogs of this regime.
Let me ask Reza Saya, final question. We just have 30 seconds, and that is, do you expect Iran's relations with the U.S. might change under Pezeshkian, and particularly the issue of nuclear weapons?
Well, that's the big question. How will things change? It's hard to say. The likelihood is that things are not going to change significantly, certainly immediately. Pezeshkian faces a conservative-dominated government. You know, that's a challenge of entrenched power structures that call the shots in foreign policy, including the supreme leader. These power structures call the shots when it comes to Iran's foreign policy, the nuclear issue, its backing of regional militias. But I think certainly it's likely that the tone of the government is going to change.
And we're going to have to leave it there, Reza Saya. I want to thank you for being with us, independent journalist in Tehran and Marjan Satrapi, French-Iranian filmmaker. This is Democracy Now!
Tuned in to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO. In accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Executive Committee meets on the second Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. Meetings are held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify that a meeting is being held.
To KBOO for our annual live broadcast of the Cathedral Park Jazz Festival, broadcasting from Friday, July 19th through Sunday, July 21st. This year's festival features Johnny Wheels and the Swamp Donkeys, Jujuba, and Tyrone Hendrix and the PDX Soul Collective. Again, that's KBOO's broadcast of the Cathedral Park Jazz Festival, live from St. John's. The broadcast starts at 4:30 p.m. on Friday and at 1 p.m. on Saturday and Sunday. More information can be found at kboo.fm/cathedralpark24.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a heat wave continues to bake the Portland metro area into midweek.
A Muslim woman who was arrested in Multnomah County was forced to remove her hijab in jail.
And in national news, immigration advocates are calling out a decision by ICE to end free phone calls for detainees.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, July 8th, 2024. I'm Artie Wall.
And I'm Mike Fdaklis. Triple-digit temperatures continue to bake the Portland area until at least Wednesday. Three cooling shelters are open from noon to 10 p.m. in Multnomah County on Monday and Tuesday. They are Cook Plaza and 19421 Southeast Stark Street in Gresham, Portland Covenant Church at 4046 Northeast MLK, and Congregation Beth Israel at 1972 Northwest Flanders in Portland are also open for the next 2 days. Cooling shelters offer food and water in a safe, air-conditioned space. The county says no one will be turned away and pets are welcome. TriMet won't turn away anyone riding to or from a cooling center who can't pay the fare. Folks can also find a free ride to a cooling center by calling 211. The county is also recruiting community volunteers to support the shelters. There is still a state of emergency related to the heat in Portland and Multnomah County. Multnomah County officials say that 4 people have died from the heat over the holiday weekend. Details are limited, but 3 of those who died were in southeast Portland. That's an area of the city with much less tree cover, meaning it can get and stay much hotter during heat waves. The National Weather Service warns that Monday and Tuesday will be the hottest days of the heat wave yet. Heat-related illnesses are significantly more common during extreme heat events like these, so it's important to know the signs of heat exhaustion and heat stroke. Jason Helper from the Mayo Clinic News Network explains.
Your body is like a car's engine. If it starts to overheat, the warning light goes on, and that is heat exhaustion.
Which is where you feel nauseous or dizzy, or you just don't feel right, and you're sweating profusely.
Anyone at any age can suffer from heat exhaustion. High temperatures, particularly when paired with high humidity, are the primary cause.
Ways to prevent it include hydrating a lot, dressing appropriately for the weather, going into an air-conditioned place when you don't feel quite right, taking breaks if you're outside working.
Without prompt treatment, heat exhaustion can lead to heat stroke, a life-threatening condition that requires emergency medical attention.
The management of heat stroke is giving them fluids and dunking them into a cool ice water bath as quickly as possible.
A common symptom of heat stroke is an altered mental state or behavior.
The pearl, I always say, is to look for confusion. If they are confused, they are having heat stroke. If anybody is in the heat and they're feeling nauseous and just not quite right, they should take a break, hydrate with cool water, and just sit down for a little bit and let their body cool down.
For the Mayo Clinic News Network, I'm Jason Howland.
During the heat wave, people are encouraged to check on their friends and neighbors who might live alone or not have access to air conditioning.
As Oregon is seeing its first major heat event of the summer, some simple tips can help you keep your home cooler. Most of Oregon was under a heat advisory over the holiday weekend. And with summer just starting, Cameron Starr with Energy Trust of Oregon says more hot days are likely ahead. He says that one recommendation is to keep out of the heat by pulling down window shades during the hottest part of the day and open windows when temperatures cool down.
During that time when it's cool outside, a box fan or window-mounted fan on the shady side of the house can really be effective in drawing in cool air.
Excessive heat can be dangerous. Starr says cooling centers are open across the state for people struggling with the heat. He also notes that you can visit many local businesses with air conditioning to cool down. Starr advises people to use heat-generating devices such as ovens less frequently during hot days. He adds that it's important to check the filters in your air conditioners, especially if they're windows-mounted or portable units.
You want to make sure that you're checking those filters. And a lot of manufacturers state to check and clean those every 2 weeks. And if you've got pets, you probably want to increase that cycle.
For people with fans, Starr says check to ensure it's spinning in the direction that cools, allowing you to feel a breeze rather than pulling cool air upward. And make sure there aren't any gaps in the doors and windows is also important.
Sealing off any gaps can very much help reduce the amount of cool air that you're losing to the outside.
Energy Trust offers cash incentives for people to install systems that cool or provide heat during the winter. There are also federal tax credits available for equipment like energy-efficient heat pumps.
A Muslim woman taken into custody at Multnomah County Jail was made to take off her hijab in front of male deputies in a potential civil rights violation. Initially, she refused, but after a tense interaction with jail deputies, she took off the headscarf. Serene Abulawa was arrested at a protest in support of Palestine at Portland's Grand Floral Parade last month. Jail deputies forced her to take off her hijab, a religious headscarf worn by Muslim women. The hijab is traditionally not taken off in front of men, except for family members. Protocol at the sheriff's office says removing a hijab should be done by someone of the same gender and out of view of male staff. That didn't happen. Abulawa's hijab was removed and not returned to her, even as she was sent to a cell for 3 hours. She was photographed without her hijab, and multiple male deputies saw her without the headscarf. Aya Baydoun is a legal fellow at the Council on American-Islamic Relations. Baydoun told the Portland Mercury, quote, "It's deeply unsettling, it's deeply offensive, disrespectful, and it's illegal. It's a violation of their religious rights because for Muslim women who wear the hijab, this is a mandate," end quote. Abu Lawa is considering legal actions against Multnomah County. In a similar case in 2017, a Muslim woman won an $85,000 lawsuit after police forcibly removed her hijab.
Groups that advocate for people detained in immigration facilities are calling for the reinstatement of a program that allowed 500 free minutes of phone calls per month. In recent weeks, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, known as ICE, cut off the free domestic and international calls, telling advocates that the pandemic-era funding has run out. Rosa Santana with the Envision Freedom Fund says families of the detainees often struggle to afford calls, which can cost up to $3 for 15 minutes.
Usually the person who is in detention is the breadwinner, and now families have to be able to figure out how they could bring food and everything that the breadwinner used to bring, pay rent, and on top of that now is like having to pay for phone calls.
ICE did not respond to a request for comment. People in at least 16 ICE detention centers across the country have reported losing access to the free calls, including three sites in California, Golden State Annex, Mesa Verde Processing Center, and Otay Mesa Detention Center. Kareem Golding with the nonprofit Freedom to Thrive says that the phone calls are a lifeline for people in detention, a connection to family that keeps their spirits up. In addition, a human rights group worry this could make it harder to monitor conditions on the inside.
Absent these phones, how would we know that rights are being violated? How would we know if nobody has the ability to communicate?
People in detention do still have access to work programs where they can earn about a dollar for 8 hours of work to spend on calls or items that are at commissary.
Wildfires in central and southern Oregon caused temporary evacuations. According to Central Oregon Fire Information, the McCaffrey Fire burning east of the Redmond Airport has grown to 458 acres. It is currently burning on Prineville District Bureau of Land Management land. As of 9 a.m. today, the fire is 25% contained as firefighters battle hot and dry conditions. However, firefighters are currently working on mopping up the perimeter in order to increase containment, and have already identified and contained several hotspots outside of the perimeter. The Deschutes County Sheriff's Office issued a Go Now evacuation order for parts of the county Saturday afternoon, but lowered the order to Be Set by Saturday evening. According to Redmond Airport Director Zachary Bass, the airport was closed for about 5 hours on Saturday as a result of the fire. The cause of the fire is under investigation. According to the Oregon Department of Forestry, or ODF, the Salt Creek Fire is raging in southern Oregon, around 30 miles east of Medford. The fire was first reported on Sunday afternoon, covering between 2 and 5 acres, but spread quickly. It now covers 1,500 acres on both private and Bureau of Land Management land.
Boeing struck a plea deal with the Justice Department to settle two 737 MAX crashes in 2018 and 2019. But family members of the crash victims say that the deal doesn't uphold justice and that Boeing should have to go to a public trial. KBOO's Grant Button has more on the story.
Boeing pled guilty to one charge of conspiracy to defraud the U.S. government, the Justice Department announced in a court filing Sunday evening. This comes after two fatal Boeing 737 crashes, where Boeing admitted that their employees withheld information about an autopilot design flaw from the Federal Aviation Administration. The plea deal only covers the two 737 MAX crashes, not the more recent Alaska Airlines flight incident where a panel flew off mid-flight over Portland. Boeing will pay up to $487 million in fines to the families of victims of these crashes. Boeing will also have to operate under the oversight of an independent monitor chosen by the government. Boeing has also agreed to spend $455 million on its compliance and safety programs over the next 3 years. The Justice Department stated that they are solely resolving issues with the company and providing no immunity to any individual employees. but the victims' families say that the settlement did not uphold justice. Ike Riffle is a California resident who lost both of his sons in one of the crashes. He said, quote, "Without full transparency and accountability, nothing will change. With this deal, there will be no investigation. There will be no expert witness testimony. There will be no perpetrators of these crimes to answer the charges in court," end quote. Paul Castle is a law professor at the University of Utah who has represented many family members of crash victims. He said that the deal is clearly not in the interest of the public and does not adequately recognize Boeing's conspiracy, since there will be no public trial on the charges as family member victims had hoped. The settlement agreement still must be approved by a judge, and lawyers of family member crash victims plan to ask them to reject the agreement. For KABU News, I'm Grant Bunn.
You're listening to the KABU Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Making Contact. At 6, it's Labor Radio. At 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline. Then at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather is clear skies with a low of 84. Tomorrow's weather is sunny with a high of 102. Today in history, Venus Williams won at Wimbledon for the first time, defeating the defending champion Lindsay Davenport. Williams went on to win 7 Grand Slam singles titles, 16 Grand Slam doubles titles, and 4 Olympic gold medals. The quote of the day is from Douglas Adams, an English author and satirist best known for his Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy scripts and book. He said, "We don't have to save the world. The world is big enough to look after itself. What we have to be concerned about is whether or not the world we live in will be capable of sustaining us in it." End quote.
Former President Donald Trump denies any knowledge of the conservative Project 2025. President Joe Biden aims to reassure Democrats he's up for the job. And the Wisconsin Supreme Court reverses a near-total ban on ballot drop boxes. With more on the story, it's Catherine Carley with 2024 Talks.
Welcome to 2024 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
We are in the process of the second American Revolution, which will remain bloodless if the left allows it to be.
Kevin Roberts, president of the right-wing Heritage Foundation, defends the Supreme Court's ruling giving presidents legal immunity for official acts. The ruling could be used to overturn former President Donald Trump's felony conviction and pave the way for Project 2025, a roadmap for a second Trump term Roberts helped write. That plan calls for national abortion and contraception bans, an expansion of presidential powers, cuts to Social Security and Medicare, profoundly limiting the FBI, and firing any federal employee not loyal to Trump. Trump is denying knowledge despite some top advisors working on it. Florida Senator Marco Rubio, a potential VP pick, distanced the campaign from Project 2025, calling it just the work of a think tank.
They come up with ideas. They say things. I like Heritage Foundation. I agree with some of the things they stand for, but there's a bunch of scholars and people that turn around and work on different projects. But our candidate for president is Donald Trump.
The Biden campaigns as its evidence that Trump and his allies are a threat to democracy. Another potential Trump VP pick, Ohio Senator J.D. Vance, is defending Trump's vow to appoint a special prosecutor to investigate President Joe Biden.
Joe Biden has done exactly that for the last few years and has done far more in addition to that to engage in a campaign of lawfare against his political opposition.
Trump was convicted of covering up hush money payments to a porn star in a New York City court, and there's no evidence Biden is involved in 2 Justice Department cases against the former president. The DOJ historically acts independently from the White House, something Trump says he would change. Biden campaigned in 2 battleground states, Wisconsin and Pennsylvania. At a black church service in Philadelphia, he urged his supporters to stay unified.
You know, I've been doing this a long time, and I, honest to God, have never more optimistic about America's future if we stick together.
At least 5 Democratic lawmakers have called for him to end his campaign. 4 more are reportedly considering joining them. Vice President Kamala Harris and members of the Congressional Black Caucus were in New Orleans, where she focused on the threat of another Trump presidency. The Wisconsin Supreme Court has reversed a near-total ban on the use of ballot drop boxes. Paulina Gutierrez with the Milwaukee Election Commission says responding to threats and false claims of voter fraud, her city will increase security.
Every time we are handling ballots, it's always more than one person. We have security cameras at all of our drop box locations and looking at ways that we can enhance now.
At least 29 other states allow for absentee ballot drop boxes, and expanded use in Wisconsin could impact the election there. I'm Catherine Carley for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem held a public safety summit with U.S. officials and some tribes, all amidst her ban from several of the Native reservations in the state. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. One tribal official is offering details into the Tribal Public Safety Crisis Summit recently held by South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem. Noem convened the summit after tribes banned her for comments she made about cartels on reservations and about Native children not having any hope. South Dakota Public Broadcasting's Lee Strubinger has more.
At least two tribes, Flinders Santee and Standing Rock Sioux tribes, sent members to the summit to hear from the governor and other law enforcement officials. Representatives from the U.S. Attorney's Office and Attorney General also attended. Francis Wakeman is a spokesperson for the Flinders Santee Sioux tribe. He attended the summit and says it was a good first step.
The governor was very interested in going to Congress with the tribes asking for additional appropriations that would benefit both the tribal and the state law enforcement. But everything's being held up because, you know, the BIA isn't providing the data that reflects the necessity for the governor and the tribes to go to Congress and ask for more money.
He says no mutual aid agreements were made during the meeting. That's something Governor Noem wants to see happen in the future. Noem has said that could help with cross-jurisdictional law enforcement issues. Currently, state law enforcement cannot go onto tribal lands, and tribal police cannot enforce the law off of reservations. Wakeman says that's something they heard about from law enforcement officials.
The governor got everybody in the right room and stuff like that, but it was interesting to hear from law enforcement, not the governor or not the heads of the tribes or anything like that, but actually the people that are on the ground doing the work, and that was very eye-opening.
Wakeman says many Native nations were not in attendance, as the summit was held the day before celebrations for the Battle of Little Bighorn, when Lakota and Northern Cheyenne defeated General Custer in what is now southeastern Montana. The governor's office says all nine tribes were represented at the summit, but at least three tribes, Lower Brule, Rosebud, and Yankton, confirmed to SDPB they did not send representatives to attend the summit. When asked to clarify, the governor's spokesperson, Ian Fury, said, quote, there were tribal members in attendance. For National Native News, I'm Lee Strubinger in Rapid City.
Lake County commissioners turned down Montana Governor Greg Gianforte's offer to temporarily pay for law enforcement services on the Flathead Reservation. Montana Public Radio's Aaron Bolton reports this is part of an ongoing fight over who will manage felony crimes.
Lake County this spring was set to leave a long-standing agreement to arrest and prosecute tribal members for felony crimes, citing the cost of those services. But Governor Gianforte argued the county couldn't leave because of a paperwork technicality. Gianforte offered the county $1.3 million over the next 3 years. The governor said that money would give commissioners and the Confederated Salish and Kootenai tribes time to work out funding. The commissioners argued in a letter that the state is trying to buy time while it, too, tries to step away from the deal. Commissioners say the state is responsible for law enforcement on the Flathead Reservation, and the county will bill the state for enforcement of felony crimes. Gianforte has previously said the state is not responsible for law enforcement on the reservation. His office did not respond for comment by deadline. In Columbia Falls, I'm Aaron Bolton.
A new center at the University of Arizona, designated by the U.S. Department of Education, is working to help tribal communities revitalize and maintain their languages. The New West Region Native American Language Resource Center is one of four inaugural centers doing similar work. Others are in Hawaii, Oregon, and Nebraska. The U of A Center is focusing on indigenous communities in Arizona, California, Nevada, and Utah. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Tropical storm Beryl battered Houston and its suburbs this morning. Beryl first made a landfall in the U.S. at 4 a.m. today, listed as a Category 1 hurricane. At least 2 people were killed. It cut down trees and caused torrential downpour, turning highways into rivers. Power outages were widespread and have affected over 2.5 million people. Officials urge Houston residents to shelter as if a tornado were passing through, as winds reached upwards of 60 miles per hour. Both of Houston's major airports have been closed due to the Beryl. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration predicts that there will be between 17 and 25 named storms this year, an above normal amount. This is due to warmer ocean temperatures brought on by the human-caused climate crisis. Heightened sea surfaces temperatures can strengthen storms more rapidly than usual.
Janitors and security officers who work at some of the largest employers in Oregon have signed new labor contracts. Members of SEIU Local 49 increased their pay and benefits and pushed for better safety standards at Portland area job sites. SEIU also represents workers in Idaho and Washington. KBOO's Grant Button has more.
Members of the Service Employees International Union start this week in the Portland area with new contracts for their work. SEIU Local 49 members work as security officers and janitorial staff for some of the biggest employers in the Pacific Northwest. The Portland team bargained for about a month and gained wage increases, additional paid leave, and health and safety improvements. Renato Quintero, a janitor at Intel, says they had to work hard to make these changes, but he thinks the effort was worthwhile.
So those things are really good for our work and for our family too. You know, they've been able to have more money and also time to enjoy our family life.
The new contracts will affect nearly 2,000 workers in the Portland metro area. The union expects the wage increases to add $9 million to the local economy. In addition to pay, union leaders say the new contracts come with a sense of recognition. They note people in these professions worked through the pandemic and their jobs were considered essential. Michael Lindsay, a security officer with Garda World Security Services, sees these contracts as a step into the future.
This is a new era for unions, especially coming out of the pandemic, and I'm excited to see what the next few years hold for us.
Lindsay predicts the new contracts will allow employees to focus on their jobs more. He also expects a decrease in staff turnover, which will result in an increase in staff experience. For KBOO News and the Public News Service, I'm Grant Bunn.
Climate activists say action to fight global warming can also improve mental health by replacing people's despair with hope. Susan Potter has more on the story in California.
Advocates fighting for climate change say climate action is increasingly seen as good, not just for the environment, but for people's psyche as well. A 2022 United Nations study highlights the impact of environmental changes on mental health and well-being. Dr. Emma Lawrence, who heads the Climate Care Center at Imperial College London, says countries first have to reckon with the harms imposed by climate change.
These impacts increase food and water insecurity, crop failure, livelihood instability, forced migration, community breakdown, disruption of access to healthcare. That can lead to anxiety, depression, post-traumatic stress disorder, substance misuse, and even death by suicide.
Researchers estimate that mental health effects related to climate change will have a total societal cost of $23 billion in 2020 and rise to $245 billion by 2050. Lawrence is leading a global research project called Connecting Climate Minds, involving more than 500 people in 80 countries. 18-year-old Finn Doze co-chairs the Bay Area Youth Climate Summit in San Francisco and is part of a research project on emotions related to climate change. He says young people who do climate work feel less isolated and pessimistic.
They have an extreme awareness about climate, which gives them a lot of fear and anxiety, but they have way more optimism because they can feel the people power and connection.
A 2022 study from Yale found that taking part in collective climate-related action may help relieve what's become known as eco-anxiety. Experts also suggest techniques to strengthen people's responses to stress, including eating well, exercising, practicing mindfulness, and building up social connections through climate work. This story was produced with original reporting by Elizabeth Hewitt for the website Reasons to be Cheerful. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Monday, July 8th, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Grant Button and Nina Mayfair. The producer and engineer is Althea Billings. Special thanks to Eric Tagadoff, Antonia Gonzalez, Catherine Carley, Danielle Smith, and Suzanne Potter. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Mike Fdaklis.
And I'm Artie Wall. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for Making Contact.
It's also a moment of hope.
You're listening to sound from the student encampment at the University of California, Berkeley, on the anniversary of the Nakba.
This movement, this student movement, this alumni